Okay, we're going to take your calls as we talk about uncharted big data and how that affects all of you when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast, and our two special guests, of course, Erez Eden and JB Michel, as we talk about their work uncharted. Fascinating technology that keeps going. Technologically speaking, Erez, not just with, you know, data and social networking, but in terms of technology, what's left out there? What are they working on way down the road?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, this kind of brings me, reminds me to this old chestnut about the patent office, where I believe the commissioner of the patent office in 1899 is said to have remarked that they were simply going to completely run out of inventions. There was going to be nothing left to invent. I think the quote is, everything that can be invented has been invented. It's probably actually just an apocryphal story, but I think it's absolutely the case that some it's just hard to tell. It's hard to tell what lies in the distant future. Certainly, I think, one of the spaces that is going to be, incredibly exciting that, I sort of like to speculate about is, when I think about data, we're going to start to learn a lot of data about our personal health. I think one of the things that's very, very exciting space is you look at telemedicine, people are now carrying around a computer essentially in their pocket. It's not just a computer, it's a very, very complicated set of sensors, right? There's a magnetometer in there. You can figure out what the humidity is in the vicinity of your phone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you can start to think of that as, something like a tricorder, a device that is constantly recording information, or that could be constantly recording information that's relevant to your body. And if you look at things like the Fitbit, which is constantly tracking people's activity, or the Scanadu Scout, it's a little bit of more ambitious technology, which can do things like a three-lead EKG in a very, very small handheld device. So I think what you're starting to see is the ability not just to, monitor things like your communications with others, people's communications are becoming digital. I think a lot of your physical processes are going to start to leave a digital footprint. And I think that's going to transform the way that medicine works. Today, you typically go to your doctor for a checkup, say once every few months. I think that's going to be flipped. You're going to start having doctors who, in some sense, you give your doctor access to a real-time stream of data about you, and they say, hey, why don't you come on in if something strange seems to come up in your signal.
That's true. Do you think it was the smartphone that jump-started all of this?
I think the smartphone certainly helps. It was really the first time we had powerful embarked computation with us and embarked sensors with us. So that opened a completely new world. It's really crazy to imagine that it's only in 2007 that this was made possible. In 2006, we didn't have really smartphones. There were some, but they were nowhere near as dominant as the iPhone came to be. So I think you're right that the smartphone is a big advance on that front.
It's like a little tiny computer, handheld computer. That's what it is.
That's right.
Amazing. Let's take some calls here for both of you. Let's go to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Ben is with us. Hey, Ben, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
This may be a little off topic, but it's still talking about data and that's available on the Internet, and it really alarmed me. My daughter called me a few days ago. She was searching on the Internet for a better deal on her car insurance. And she got on an insurance website, and they said, these three cars have been seen at your house. Which one is yours? They had her car, my car, and her sister's car on there. And I was just astounded when I heard this.
Wow. Yeah, this is astounding. That's pretty insane. I think that's a... Do you have a question related to that, or do you want us to...
react to that?
To react? Well, because I think this is right. This is one of the new features of this world, right? Where big data is one of the side effects of big data is that every once in a while, like when your daughter did this search, we realize that some people out there, some corporations out there, know a hell of a lot more about us than we could ever imagine. And yes, we discover that some car company actually knows which car we have. There was this story recently, not that recently actually, I think maybe 2-3 years ago, where I think it was the shop Target sent to the home of a girl, I think a minor, who was pregnant, sent to the home of this girl, congratulations on your upcoming, birth. Yeah. And that was sent to her parents' home, and she hadn't told her parents yet. So that was, this type of thing is always extremely unsettling. I think I guess that this type of thing will become only more frequent in the few years to come as we learn how to set the boundaries of that. This is very new territory. This is very uncharted territory. And I understand that feeling. I have that feeling myself of you feel violated a bit, when some companies out there know this type of stuff about you.
JB, have we gone too far too fast?
I think we've gone very far quite fast. That's true. I don't know that we're too far. I think one advantage, by the way, of the connected world in which we live is that this type of problems, when they arise, are made known very quickly. So, for instance, users are just exposed to the world of this issue with car insurance, and so I think this is actually a positive thing. And so we're able to, even though we've gone very far, very fast, we may still have the feedback mechanisms that are fast enough for us to correct these trajectories. So I'm quite hopeful.
How about you, Aris? Too far, too fast?
Well, I don't know. I'm always curious what's going to happen next. So we've gone very, very far. But, ultimately, I guess I'm optimistic. I think that, humanity, if you think about how far we've come from the Paleolithic, come a very, very long way. And somehow we've managed to, I think, bend our technology, in general, towards our mutual benefit. So there's dangers out there, but I'm a technological optimist.
Let's go next. First-time caller, Martel in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Martel, you are up.
Hi, I was calling to ask the guest if the engram had any relation to Terrence McKenna's time wave zero theory, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Well, I don't know, Erez, if we could answer that or not.
So what is the theory? I did not quite...
One of Terrence McKenna's theories. McKenna.
I'm unfamiliar with the details of...
Let's move on.
Of his theory.
We will move on indeed. Big Brother watching us. How much more data do they want to get from us?
All of it, I would imagine. I think there is if we're talking about, as scientists, for instance, as a scientist, I would want all the data, because, like, literally all the data. I would like, as a scientist, to know, if I'm not concerned about ethics at all, I would like to know what everybody is doing at any point in time, anywhere, so that I can understand better the dynamics of, of society. Of course, then ethics start to come into play. Then, as a government, I guess I might also want to know what everybody's doing at all times so that I can make sure national security is all right. As a citizen, I'm not sure I would like to know. I would like that to happen. So I'm not sure where that leads us, really, quite frankly.
I guess it is kind of exciting, though, knowing that technology is going to continue to just burst on the scene, isn't it?
Of course, it's fascinating. I think, as a social scientist, or as a scientist interested in the human experience, I think now is a really fascinating time for us because these technologies, internet, big data, are essentially ways for us to build measuring instruments for human society and for human history. So you know how in physics we have measuring instruments like that tell us the quality of light or the hardness of a material or the intensity of a sound. In biology, we have microscopes that tell us, that enable us to see microorganisms and measure birth rates. But in the social sciences, when you're interested in the human society, our history and our culture, our language, we don't have a tool, we don't have a physical object, you know, that we can point and extract measurements from. And that's changing. Big data is giving us these type of tools. It's making it possible for us to build these type of tools, to build telescopes for cultural trends and social trends. And that's when you can see things that you could not see before, when you have tools that open ways of seeing that were previously unavailable, you discover new stuff. You discover new things, and that's a fantastic moment as a scientist.
All right, next up, let's go to Greg in New Mexico, first-time caller. Hi, Greg, you're up with us.
Hi Joey. Great show. I wanted to ask a question to you, the two gentlemen. You mentioned, George, a minute ago, have we gone too far, you know, too quick. You know, with the greed, you know, and the immaturity of some of these companies that exploit, you know, people worldwide, are there any countermeasures that are being implemented or will be implemented? What can we do to protect ourselves in certain circumstances like that? I'll hang up and let him answer. Thank you very much, George.
All right. Erez, I'm not sure the individual can stop any of this.
Well, I mean, that's not totally true. I mean, I think that there are a lot of fairly simple things, you know, that people can do. You know, I mean, there are tools that, you know, allow folks to browse the internet more anonymously. There are email services that will, you know, promise to encrypt your email, promise to delete your email under certain circumstances. I think the major issue is, you know, what are the costs there, right? You know, if that's less convenient, if it's slower, are people willing to pay that cost? I mean, to a huge extent, the reason, for instance, that many people's email lives in the cloud is that it's just more convenient for it to live in the cloud rather than for it to live on your computer, because you can access it very, very quickly from anywhere. But we're very, very often in this position where we're trading off security for convenience on the internet and in the cloud. The question is how we make that decision, where is that choice point, that's going to differ. That's going to differ for different people. But, I mean, there certainly are, you know, more and sort of less secure options that exist. I mean, Snapchat is an interesting example, right?
Sure.
There's, you know, certainly the idea of this service was, hey, you know, you can kind of create this conversation. You can interact with someone in a digital way that will disappear, that won't leave a permanent record. You know, but then on the other hand, people found, well, actually, you know, sometimes you can recover those Snapchat conversations. People stop using Snapchat? Not exactly. So, you know, I think it's a trade-off. I think people need to decide what they value and then choose services that are appropriate for where that balance point is for them.
I think, though, that the situation is complicated by the fact that as consumers, as people, we have a very limited understanding of what information it is that we're putting out there. What information is made available? What do people know about us? When we sign up for an app or when we go on a website, it's hard to really know exactly what's being pushed to the world about us. And that makes actually the decision-making process very difficult. I think there is room, and I'm sure we'll see that soon. I think there is room for a technology that helps, that makes plain to people what information you're producing and who's capturing that or who can capture that. That I think will help a great deal consumer organization.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's already starting to be this kind of pushback where people are realizing, hey, you know, I don't want to live in a world where everything is remembered, you know, where there's no such thing as forgetting, where everything is recorded. You know, so I think it's this, there's this bar, JB, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it's in Seattle, mm-hmm. That has banned Google Glass.
That's right.
It's just, you know, people like
freak
to engage
out.
In shenanigans at the bar. They don't want it to be preserved for posterity. So that's something they don't want. Actually, you know, when I was in Seattle recently, I met some folks who are doing this startup, right? Related concept. The basic idea of this startup is you give this startup your personal information, and then they become your intermediary when you sign up for a service. So when you sign up for a service, you basically, you know, tell the service, okay, go talk to these guys. These guys have my data. But you can only use it in the following ways. And if somebody wants to use it in a different way, if somebody wants to add you to a mailing list, et cetera, instead of your information being bought and sold by different companies, you're just given a payment directly. You know, yeah, you want to add me to that mailing list. Sure, I'm willing to be added to your mailing list, you know, if you pay me $1, if you pay me $5. You know, so all of a sudden, at least, you know, it's not that other people are selling their information you know, for their benefit. We have, you know, we have that control. If information about me is an economically valuable asset, I ought to be able to control that information. I thought that was a cool concept that they were working on.
How do people get their apps so quickly? I mean, how does, like Snapchat, how does it race around the planet so fast?
Well, I think, it's really interesting. I think it's network effect, essentially. I think they tap into the fact that just like you pointed out earlier on Twitter, right? The information can spread to the entire world in a matter of minutes, and so now, because of these networks, I think a successful application, something that's, you know, people call it viral application or viral concepts, can spread extremely fast when they. And then exactly what makes them viral, I think, is still unknown. We really don't know. We can theorize about that. We can have ideas, but I don't think anybody knows.
And when we come back, I want to ask you, too, about Time Wave Zero, which was a software program that mapped out major moments in humanity's evolution. See if you, too, know about that. And we'll take some final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed it is. And this is, of course, our final segment here as we talk with Erez Aydin and J.B. Michel. Their work is called Uncharted. On our next Coast to Coast program, we've got a split show for you, too, with all kinds of great things. So just go to our website at coasttocoastam.com. Do that daily and just search around. We're going to come back with final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Erez and J.B., there's something called Time Wave Zero, which had to do with a program to map moments in humanity's evolution. Are you two familiar with that at all?
I am not.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, and that's what the other caller was making reference to with Terrence McKenna, a theory, of course, I'm not aware of either. When apps are developed, what's the brain power behind them, and how do they say, we need this for that? How does that work? Erez?
Oh, well, I mean, I think this is, you know, a process of kind of cultural evolution by spontaneous mutation, right? Some random person somewhere thinks, hey, I think we need an app for recording what you're doing right now in 140 characters or less. Turns out that that's actually a pretty darn useful thing to be doing. It catches on. Tons of people use it.
Someone could have come up with an app for recording what you're doing in 20 characters or less. Presumably that was not quite as useful, and so it didn't get taken up. I mean, I think if you look at apps, vast majority of them aren't being used by anyone, but a couple of them turn out to be incredibly useful, very, very small subpopulation. So we hear more about them.
How do they make money on apps? Most of them are free.
Go ahead, JB, sorry.
Yeah, I think a lot of apps try to make money with ads. I tried to look into that. I'm not sure I got to the primary data yet, but like, for instance, there's this Flappy Bird app that was immensely popular until last week. And I think the number that came around was like this app was making $50,000 a day in ad revenue, and that corresponded to about 2 million downloads a day. I think those numbers are the ones that I recall. I apologize if I'm propagating false rumors. That's the nature of the internet. I think they try to make money with ads. My guess, though, is that it's not working just great for most apps. So they're probably trying to find revenue other ways.
All right, back to the phones now we go. We'll go to Sharon in St. Augustine, Florida, first-time caller. Sharon, go ahead.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to get his name again, please.
Which one? We have two for you.
Either one, fine.
Okay. We have Erez Aiden and okay. JB Michel.
All right.
There you go.
Okay. First of all, what on the spiritual end of this, how does that play in? When you fast for a very long time, you seem to be able to look into the future.
Okay, explain that a little bit more.
Okay, I went on an 8-week fast.
Okay.
Okay, and the longer you're on a fast, the closer you're able to prophesy. You're able to see into the future.
All right, that's a question that they're not going to be able to answer for you because we're dealing with high technology and the future, so that won't work. Good try, though. Good try. Let's go next to Gabriel in San Luis Obispo, California. Gabriel, go ahead.
Hey, George and JB, and I forgot the other gentleman's name. I apologize, but I know you guys already kind of touched on this, but big data and how it, has the power of kind of tracking some of the things we do online. And you brought up the gentleman who had the daughter who, they knew what kind of car she had and whatnot. And like just the power of that is really kind of interesting. And obviously the implications, I think JB was mentioning, it's interesting in terms of looking at things from a social and cultural perspective, and you get to see trends and stuff like that develop. But I was interested in their opinion on the impact it might have. I don't know if they're familiar with the concept of filter bubbles, but just let's say, George, me going to your website on Coast to Coast and looking up your contact information, that's registered in my browser, and therefore, future, when I type in different things into Google or something or another browser, let's say in the future, things related to your show or concepts like that may be the things that are initially popped up, and I may have certain information, that Google thinks it should exclude based on my interests. And so, when you think about the democratic process, Democrats, Republicans have their, or we'll just say conservatives and liberals tend to have different viewpoints. And so they're going to be less likely to be exposed to things that challenge those viewpoints. And I was wondering what they think about that and how that influences, especially considering what they talked about with investigative journalism earlier.
Either one of you two want to handle that?
Sure. I mean, I think the point, I think, is dead on. The early internet didn't have this property. It was a heck of a lot less personalized, and as a result, it was in some sense unifying in a way that the internet today isn't unifying. It's incredibly siloed in a lot of respects. Even something as ubiquitous as Google is going to personalize things for a user, which is helpful. In the sense that Google has a pretty good idea of what are the kinds of things that you like are likely to click on, and they'll show those things to you. But when it comes time to exposing yourself to new ideas, to not seeing the same kinds of views that you've become accustomed to, it can be harder to escape that. And I think that's, you know, it's a tricky thing. I mean, there's, you know, an interesting, and there are starting to be browsers and tools that say, hey, we're not going to personalize, you know, we're not going to bubble you. We're just going to present the same exact results to everybody. And, you know, you can choose for yourself what you want to click on, what you want to learn about, but you don't end up in this silo in quite the same way.
You have also quoted in the book Uncharted, of course, you write about Helen Keller, that she once said, it's impossible to kill an idea. Is that true?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the things that we talk about in the book is the Nazi effort to stamp out ideas during World War II. And, you know, in point of fact, you know, the Nazis were not successful in their effort to eradicate a wide variety of ideas, but it would be facile to say that's because it couldn't possibly have happened in the way that Helen Keller wrote in a famous letter. In point of fact, if you look at the effect of Nazi efforts at censorship, at suppression of information, at stripping books from libraries, burning books, they're actually very, very effective at removing a wide variety of ideas from the common discourse. I think some folks have done, I believe Margaret Stieg Dalton, a research librarian, did some really outstanding work showing that the libraries in some major industrial centers, about 70% of the books that had been in them before the war were gone by the 1940s. And if you think, I mean, in an age before the internet, by removing those books from the library, you're removing those concepts from the general discourse. And a lot of these books were extremely highly circulated books before the war. So they were really extremely effective at reshaping the intellectual landscape of Nazi Germany. So I don't know, the jury's still out on whether you can kill an idea, but it's certainly the case that the Nazis were able for an extended period of time to significantly suppress a wide variety of ideas. And that's something that still goes on today. Actually, there's one of the charts that we show in the book shows the frequency of Tiananmen Square over time, both in English and in Chinese. And the argument that we make in the book is if you look at those trajectories, you can very clearly see the effects of suppression of information regarding the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre in China. You know, and sometimes, I don't know, you know, art imitates life, which then imitates art. You know, when our book was being sold at auction in China, we started to get contacted by Chinese publishers who said, you know, hey, this book is great. We want to bid on this book, but, you know, would you be willing, before we bid on it, to agree to remove a couple of pages, which we think are no good for China? And of course, the pages that they were referring to were the pages about Tiananmen Square. So, you know, it's actually kind of ironically our n-gram chart, a line graph showing the suppression of Tiananmen Square, information about Tiananmen Square in China, is itself, you know, sort of under, you know, sort of censored, banned in China. There's a lot of pressure not to publish material like that. So those kinds of things, you know, are happening. They're happening the world over, and you can sometimes see them now using these kinds of the types of approaches that we discuss in the book.
What happens when one day the internet goes down? All this collapses, doesn't it? All of us.
That's a very interesting thought. I find it hard to imagine a world where the internet goes down, actually. I really don't see it possible. It's kind of like imagining, like, just everybody stopping to speak their mother tongue and switching to some other language. I would think, you know, there's a faint probability that this can occur, but I wouldn't really count on it. I don't think I would see that.
In case something takes down the power grid or something like that.
Yes, that's the nice thing about the internet, which is that it's very decentralized. So unless there is complete absence of power everywhere on Earth, you will still have a lot of the information available. It might take down some parts of it, might be true, but I think for the most part, information is so decentralized, so spread out in so many different places that you would probably keep a big part of it.
All right, let's take some final calls here. Let's go to Rayetta in Texas, east of the Rockies. Hey, Rayetta.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I wanted to ask the gentleman, can this technology that's going so fast get out of control?
JB, how about you? Can the technology get out of control?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think it can very well get out of control. I think we've seen that to some extent we are seeing that right now with the NSA, the revelations around the NSA. This is, by all accounts, out of control, literally out of control. Like there is few controls on that. And but I also think that, to repeat a point that we tried to make earlier, I also think I'm very hopeful. I'm a technologist hopeful, like Erez is. These are very powerful technologies that we're talking about, and they contain within them both the good and the bad. I am confident that the good aspects of it will prevail, and I think there are powerful mechanisms for the good aspects to prevail. So, for instance, right now, the fact that we have Twitter and the fact that information can spread so fast and so widely makes abuse of power harder than ever to conceal. It's very difficult. And so I think that makes me hopeful that even though there is absence of control from time to time, we, especially in the United States, have a capacity to react to that and to make adjustments. So I'm very hopeful.
How about you, Erez?
I mean, I think it can absolutely happen. You know, overall, am I a technology optimist? Absolutely. You know, but is it the case that humanity has from time to time unleashed technologies with horrifying consequences? I mean, I think if you look at, you know, the last century, it's impossible to disagree with that. And I think that that we just have to be vigilant as a society. I think technologists who are involved in the development of new inventions and ideas have got to be incredibly vigilant about that, because, you know, we want to be contributing to something positive. We want to be enabling positive things, and we want to be creating a public discourse when there needs to be public discourse about the potential dangers associated with technologies.
Okay, let's take another call or two. Our Skype line, by the way, is open if you want to try it at George 97313. George 97313. The book, Erez, Uncharted. Where do people get it?
Oh, you can get it any bookstore should have it. You can get it at Amazon. That's probably an easy way to get it on the web, or if people are using an ebook reader, certainly it's available for every ebook reader platform. But yeah, probably Amazon is the easiest thing to do. You know, click a button and they will have a helicopter drone deliver it to your door. Well, probably not yet, but in a couple of years.
No, you know, they had a floral company was doing that by a little drone helicopter, and the FAA literally shot it down. And,
that is right. That is right. I mean, I think it's an exciting time for drone technology. I think that's something that's really improving incredibly rapidly. I think there's a lot of exciting opportunities right now. Right now, it's especially fun, I think, for private individuals, where the FAA is not really restricting them very much. The restrictions are a lot tighter for commercial enterprises. But I think over the next couple of years, they're trying to figure out how to make that more widely available. Obviously, I think that's going to be very, it's going to have some really, really, really interesting uses,
but it is absolutely one of these technologies that can have some pretty frightening downsides.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And I'm just amazed at how fast this just continues to go. Faster and faster every moment. I think it's also speeding up our feeling of time. I mean, here we are in a few weeks. We're going into March already. We were just talking about the new year beginning. I mean, do you feel that way too? That time is just going too fast?
It's something that we talk about in our book, right? We talk about both of these things. We have actually a section in our book where we explicitly grapple with this question of, is the rate of technological progress speeding up? And we use n-grams to try to measure that and, you know, try to test this notion of, is technology speeding up? You know, are we somehow inventing things more rapidly? Are new ideas adopted more rapidly? Another thing that we also look at is, how do we relate to the past? Is that changing over time? And I think there is some evidence in the n-grams that the way that we relate to the past is actually changing, that we forget the past more rapidly as time goes by. It's really interesting because n-grams is really one of the first tools that can interrogate the historical record in such a global fashion that you can start to have very coherent questions and very, very coherent analyses. Really coming, you know, sort of from the data on questions like that, George.
All right, good job, both of you. Uncharted. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.